Yo, of the people, by the people, for the people, we the people bring the Bill of Rights back like a sequel. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Rights that we the people are born with. And they cannot be taken away. Equality, treat the people fairly. Are you hearing this? Here's a little story about Cesar Chavez, a Mexican-American, and his contribution. Chavez fought for people's rights.
20,000 workers were drafted every 10 months to help construct the project with, quote-unquote, excruciating and poorly compensated labor. Many died of cholera and other diseases.
Although the strike ultimately failed, this solidarity proved to be a turning point for LGBT rights in the UK, with the hearts and minds of minors.
Even my mother, when I first told her I was going to go to cosmetology school, she was like, oh, why do you want to do that?
First, they ignore you. Then they laugh at you. Then they fight you. Then you win. So said Mahatma Gandhi. Or did he? In this week's Labor History Today, who built the Suez Canal? Lesbians, gays, and minors build solidarity in the UK. The work that goes into styling hair. Plus, the real story behind Gandhi's labor quote. And on Labor History in 2.
The year was 2010. A massive explosion ripped through Massey Energy's mine in Raleigh County, West Virginia. The explosion killed 29 miners. It was the deadliest in decades.
I'm Chris Garlock, and that's all ahead on this week's Labor History Today. Here's the show.
Can't do it, my people. Yes, we can't do it, my people. Yes, we can't do it, my people.
The Suez Canal was in the news recently thanks to being blocked by the container ship that held up billions of dollars worth of consumer goods before being freed. What caught my eye was that the 120-mile canal, an artificial sea-level waterway in Egypt connecting the Mediterranean Sea to the Red Sea through the Isthmus of Suez and dividing Africa and Asia, was a result of the work of 1.5 million workers over 10 years, beginning in 1859. According to the Suez Canal Authority, 20,000 workers were drafted every 10 months to help construct the project with, quote-unquote, excruciating and poorly compensated labor. Many died of cholera and other diseases. When the Suez Canal was completed in 1869, the celebratory extravaganza included fireworks and a ball attended by 6,000 people. I wonder how many were those who actually dug the canal.
Good evening, and welcome to Remember Our Struggle. I'm Ariana Eckel, journeyman wireman of IBEW Local 124. Tonight, I'm going to speak to you about the National Union of Mine Workers strike of 1984 through 1985 in the UK and their most unlikeliest of allies. The coal industry in Great Britain had been nationalized in 1941, with a notice posted at every coal mine, "This colliery is now managed by the National Coal Board on behalf of the people." Mine owners were paid for their property, and management of the mines were transferred to be under the supervision of the National Coal Board, with 4% of the country's workers now being employed by a governmental agency instead of by over 800 different private employers. Fast forward to 1984. Margaret Thatcher had been elected Prime Minister in 1979, and in the time since, her party had pursued an agenda of deregulation and set about trying to undermine the power of labor unions. Word got around that the NCB had a list of mines it intended to close, and that it intended to cut coal production by 4 million tons. Modernization of equipment and other changes had already seen the coal workforce more than cut in half in recent decades, and the remaining miners were on the defensive and came to believe the time was now or never to make a final stand. Many communities across the UK had no other industries at all save their coal mines, and mine closure meant economic devastation for these communities. The NUM had a more decentralized structure than many in United States unions may be familiar with, and regions of the union acted semi-autonomously, with some regions being known to be more militant than others. Upon her election, Prime Minister Thatcher set about her plans to restructure the coal industry and intended to close mines that were considered the most inefficient, and fully expected resistance from the NUM and their president, Mr. Scargill, and planned accordingly. She directed the government to set up a 6-month stockpile of coal and appointed Ian McGregor, whom NUM President Scargill branded as that American butcher of British industries, to the helm of the NCB. Mr. McGregor had already been put at the helm of the national steel industry, and under his tenure the steel workforce had been cut in half in just 2 years, so Collier's had good reason to expect similar treatment. Ms. Thatcher also directed the police across the country to prepare for the probability of work stoppages and interruptions. On April 19, 1984, delegates at a special NUM conference voted not to have a national vote on whether to strike, as urged by President Scargill, but instead, the matter was left up to individual regions due to the vote for a national strike only being favored by a small majority of delegates. The strike was almost universally supported in Kent, Scotland, South Wales, Northeast England, and Yorkshire, but there was less support across North Wales and in the Midlands. Some mines in those regions stayed open, and the specially prepared police forces provided the strikebreakers with security. Bloody battles ensued in multiple regions between strikers and the police, the most notable being dubbed the Battle of Orgreave, which involved around 5,000 strikers and a similar number of police. The battle had begun after police cavalry attacked strikers with truncheons. Many legal attempts were made to stop the strike, from court injunctions to a ruling by one judge that the strikes were against the NUM's own constitution, as no national vote had been held on the matter. The NUM's elections that summer saw the unseating of nearly all leaders who had supported the strike and replacement with officers who did not. The matter became so divisive that many working miners broke away to form a new union, the Union of Democratic Miners, which Mr. McGregor was all too eager to recognize and work with instead. Although initially supportive of the miners and their fight to defend their livelihoods, public opinion slowly turned against the miners as most of the media coverage concentrated their reporting on the violence, and in many cases exaggerated it and falsely portrayed it as being one-sided. A court injunction then froze the strike funds of the NUM, leading to an economic crisis for striking miners and their families. One of the more interesting aspects of this strike is the tie-in with the nascent British gay rights movement. A group calling itself Lesbians and Gays Support the Miners was organized to fundraise to support striking miner families, and members shook cans on street corners and held other fundraising events, the largest of which was a concert in London dubbed Pits and Perverts. Altogether, 11 LGSM groups were founded, and cumulatively they raised over $96,000 in today's dollars to support strikers. Although the strike ultimately failed, this solidarity proved to be a turning point for LGBT rights in the UK, with the hearts and minds of miners so moved that the union marched at the front of London's Gay Pride Parade in 1985, and was instrumental in the Labour Party's passage of a resolution supporting gay rights that same year. This episode of UK Labour history was dramatized in the 2014 award-winning movie Pride, for anyone out there wanting to learn more about this story. Have a great evening, everyone.
From the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C.
Hair burner. Sometimes they call us hair burners, beauty operator. I love beauty operator. Hairstylist. I probably have said stylist more over the years. I had a business card once that I wrote coiffure, construction, maintenance, and repair on.
Welcome to America Works, excerpts from interviews with contemporary workers throughout the United States, collected by the library's American Folklife Center as part of its Occupational Folklife Project. This America Works episode features hairstylist Jeff Hafler, owner of the Beauty Bubble Hair Salon and Museum in Wonder Valley, California, was interviewed on behalf of the American Folklife Center by scholar, researcher, and Archie Green Fellow Ken Dacey Taylor.
I'm Jeffrey George Hafler. And I've been doing hair. I'm a cosmetologist since 1991. I finished high school and really didn't have any direction. I took a year off. I moved out. I got in a lot of trouble. And I realized that I couldn't spend the rest of my life doing that. A friend of mine had gone to cosmetology school, and he said that he thought I would probably be pretty good at it, and I should go and look into beauty school. You know, I'd messed around with friends' hair. I'd cut my own hair, and I'd cut my friend's hair on the porch and stuff. And so I thought, well, I could probably do that. And so I went to the offices of the Ohio State School of Cosmetology, Columbus, Ohio. The leader, the largest in Ohio. Their jingle. And it turned out that I qualified for two Pell Grants that covered just about the entire tuition. And so it turned out that I was really good at it. I finished the top of my class. And it's been great. It's been 20 years of, you know, being able to work anywhere and just pretty much always have a job because people always need a haircut. Hair is our crowning glory. I mean, I think that our hair is the first and foremost thing we think about when we think about our appearance. It defines us. You know, how you wear your hair can even change the way your face looks. Just a simple, you know, combing it forward as opposed to combing it back is going to change the way your face appears. 80% probably would prefer to have different hair. Nobody's happy with what they've got. But I do think that ultimately everyone ends up with their go-to look. Everyone has that style, you know, regardless of the trends that come and go, that looks the best, is the easiest for them. I told someone once that our hair holds energy. Like all the hair that's on your head is holding everything that happened in the period of time that it's taken to grow that hair. So imagine that at the very tips of your hair is whatever happened to you 5 years ago. And so if you cut that off, you're gonna let it go. I don't know if it's necessarily true, but you know, it kind of makes sense. I am a chatterbox, so you know, I get to talk all day long.
How much do you reveal about yourself?
Oh, everything. God, I'm an open book. I do remember that they said you shouldn't talk about religion, sex, or politics in the first chapter of my cosmetology textbook, which is all we talk about all the time. All the time. I mean, every day somebody's talking something about politics or religion or sex. All of it. Yeah, all of it. So, especially now for me being a gay married man, which, you know, that's a hotbed issue. So I bring it up too. For some reason, people confide in their hairdresser like a therapist. And I've always been really good at that too. I don't know, because I'm a talker, I'm also a really good listener. You know, this business makes you a really good listener. Sometimes your client just needs to talk the whole time. And you may end up even just nodding your head or just throwing something in on occasion, but they need to vent something. And I enjoy that, really. And in fact, I have on my price list therapy, I have listed on my price list as free. There's no charge for the therapy. And in fact, my therapy's free, but one time I had a client pay me. It was a guy. He insisted on giving me the money he would have given to a therapist. But yeah, it's I don't know what it is about the environment. It's probably because it's obviously very intimate. And in my salon especially, because it's most of the time it's one-on-one. It's just my chair and my client. Sometimes I'll have two clients going at the same time. And that's fun because sometimes you get two clients talking about the same thing, or you know, they might be able to talk about each other's problems and have something to weigh on. But yeah, people love to gossip. And for some reason, it's just part of my nature to keep up on current affairs and what's going on in town and, you know, who's doing what to who. And so, you know, people want to know. A lot of people just sit down, they're like, okay, what's going on in 29 Palms? What's the latest? And yeah, you are an entertainer when you're a hairdresser because you're entertaining your client while you're doing their hair. You have to interact and make it fun. I think the relationship you develop with your clients too, it's because you develop a friendship with people and, you know, and they stay in your life for years with the loyalty that comes along with it. Well, it is one of those industries where it doesn't get the level of respect really that it should, because it's not easy work and you can make good money. But why there's a stigma of like a hairdresser being second class, and probably again because it's a service industry job. You're serving people. I don't know too, maybe because it's like a vocation. You know, when I was in high school, the vocational school in Columbus offered cosmetology. And I wish that I would have done it. I could have been 2 years ahead of the game. They'd only let people go to vocational school, didn't really have great grades. And mine weren't great, but they said I was, you know, smarter than that. College degree's not a guarantee, though, of a job. But a vocation, however, is. Well, people think that it's not necessarily a high-paying job or that you're a servant of some sort, which is true. In fact, even my mother, when I first told her I was going to go to cosmetology school, she's like, "Ugh, why do you want to do that?" And I said, "Well, what are you talking about?" I said, "I think I'll be good at it." This has been an amazing career. All kinds of opportunity, interesting things I've seen and done. And, you know, that was another reason that it was just like I felt it was the right choice of occupation because, like I said, just get to meet a lot of people, have a lot of friends, and talk a lot.
You've been listening to hairstylist Jeff Hafler, owner of the Beauty Bubble Hair Salon and Museum in Wonder Valley, near 29 Palms, California, who was interviewed on behalf of the American Folklife Center by scholar, researcher, and Archie Green fellow Candace Taylor. To hear the complete interview with Jeff Hafler, please visit us online at www.loc.gov/folklife. On behalf of the library's American Folklife Center, this is folklorist Nancy Gross. Thank you so much for listening to America Works.
From the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C.
First, they ignore you. Then, they laugh at you. Then, they fight you. Then you win. So said Mahatma Gandhi. Or did he? According to Snopes, the fact-checking website, it was actually Union advocate Nicholas Klein in a 1914 speech at the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America, who told a story about people who came out to see the first test of a locomotive. They all said it would never work, and then, when it did, they all shouted, "You can't stop it!" "And, my friends," said Klein, "in this story you have a history of this entire movement. First they ignore you, then they ridicule you, and then they attack you and want to burn you. And then they build monuments to you. And that is what's going to happen to the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America."
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. Tomorrow marks the anniversary of the Upper Big Branch mine disaster. This is the first of two parts commemorating that moment in labor history. The year was 2010. A massive explosion ripped through Massey Energy's mine in Raleigh County, West Virginia. The explosion killed 29 miners. It was the deadliest in decades. The explosion at the Upper Big Branch mine revealed the ruthlessness of profit-driven mine executives, raking in $104 million in profit the year before, they callously insisted the explosion had been an act of God. The explosion also exposed the immense pressure on federal and state regulators to look the other way or go easy on enforcement. And it demonstrated just how deep the ties go between industry, regulators, and those in seats of political power. The Upper Big Branch mine explosion served as a testament to the increasingly unsafe and non-union nature of the industry. 35 years ago, 95% of the state's mines were unionized. Walkouts over health and safety were common. Now, less than 25% are. And the workers risk their livelihoods if they dare to speak up about safety. Autopsies of those killed in the explosion revealed that over 70% of them were found to have had black lung disease, an entirely preventable disease with proper ventilation. Massey executives routinely violated safety rules as a cost of doing business. American University's detailed study of Massey's safety record for the years 2000 through 2010 concluded that no other U.S. coal company had a worse fatality record. A total of 54 workers, including those at the Upper Big Branch mine, had been killed during that time period. They also found that Massey had been cited for nearly 63,000 violations, including more than 25,000 considered significant and substantial. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
No había quien defendiera al campesino, ni el más mínimo derecho conseguía. De las actas laborales excluidos, su derecho como humano no existía. Y aunque no quieras creer, querido amigo, esto sucede en los Estados Unidos.
that'll do it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app, and even better, if you like what you hear, and we hope that you do, please like it in your podcast app and pass it along. Spread the word. Solidarity. Labor History in 2 is a partnership between the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show, a labor-themed radio show out of Pennsylvania. Also worth checking out. Remember Our Struggle comes to us from the Heartland Labor Forum radio show out of Kansas City. We've got a link to the show in the show notes. Our music today included two songs in honor of Cesar Chavez, the co-founder of the United Farm Workers of America, born in Yuma, Arizona on March 31st, 1927. From Rap Opera for Kids, we heard the Cesar Chavez Civil Rights for Kids song, and Los Tigres del Norte performed Cesar Chavez. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Talmadovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Evan Papp, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history, and see you next time. Protestando contra los desinfectantes, Chávez hace huelga por tercera vez, por querer salvarla de sus semejantes, en su vida casi tuvo que perder. Y aunque no quieras creer, querido amigo, esto sucede en los Estados Unidos. César Chávez, César Chávez, César Chávez, como a Gandhi o Luther King yo te comparo. Por si tú no lo sabías, ya lo sabes, tienes tu lugar en el cielo apartado. Honor han de cantar un día al azar.